This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with both of the authors of quite an interesting book titled How the Spanish Empire Was Built, a 400-year history published in early 2024 from Reaction, which helps us understand where we start from in 16th century Spain being not exactly a country that is the richest, has the biggest population in Europe, is kind of doing the most things. And yet, then we get the Spanish Empire, which certainly is pretty big and doing rather a lot and very rich. This book helps us understand how we got from point A to point B, which is really quite helpful to understand. So I'm very pleased to welcome both of the authors, Felipe Fernandez-Armesto and Manuel Lucena, to the podcast. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us. It's a great treat and privilege.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you both. And I wonder if to start off with, kind of at the starting point, can you each please tell us a little bit about yourselves and most importantly, why you decided to write this book and write it together?
Well, there's nothing interesting to say about myself. Why I wanted to write the book was quite interestingly, not for the very, I know, engaging and rather exciting intellectual reason that you've just put forward, Miranda. You said that the book was interesting because it contributes to our understanding of what turned Spain from a small, marginal, unimportant part of Europe into the world's great superpower and this tremendously productive culture and civilization, which generated not only so much conquest and so much strength, but also so much intellectual and artistic greatness in the 16th and 17th centuries. And of course, you're quite right. I mean, that is a fascinating topic. But I think what I was more interested in myself was the problem of empire. How and why do empires happen? What makes them work? And especially pre-industrial empires, and especially an empire like that of Spain, which, given the fact, as you quite well put it, that this was a very small and poor country, it does seem amazing that so many people, so many cultures, literally thousands of different cultures in every habitable environment of the time became part of the Spanish polity. And I wanted to understand how that could happen, especially in a pre-industrial period, when Spaniards didn't have the technology or the manpower to force anybody really to do anything. This was empire was a collaborative venture, and I wanted to know what made it tick, what made people all over the world, all these different climates and places and cultural contexts, what made them willing to go on being part of this, first of all, to become part of that empire in the first place, and then go on being willing to do it. Manolo may have a different perspective of his own, but I think one of the things that we shared is that you know we were both under an obligation to our patron Rafael del Pino, and we were looking for a subject which would do honor to his memory in a book that we wanted to dedicate to him. And as for why we wrote it together, well, we're just very old friends and collaborators, and because we agree about most things, but also, have disagreements, that makes collaboration both possible because of the overlap and both fruitful because of the differences. And certainly for me, working with Manolo was one of the great pleasures of writing the book. But I'll let him know. I'm wrong about everything.
Well, thank you very much, Felipe and Miranda. Of course, I'm very honored just to be here. First of all, I must say I was invited because of you in order to take part in this project. I am the second author of the book. I was invited by Felipe and the Fundación del Pino. And, well, after a very long time, researching about history of science, history of technology in Spain and Hispanic and Spanish-speaking countries. Well, the idea of technologies of the South, if I can just express the idea as such. Well, I think this idea of explaining why the Spanish Empire was so successful took such a long time before disappearing at the end of the 19th century, after the 16th century onwards, why it was the first global idea and the first globalized empire in the history of humanity. Of course, we had a lot of elements just to think about. On the other hand, I think we historians have been very centered in the explanation of why the empires in general, not only pre-industrial empires, but post-industrial empires, including the British Empire. Well, there are a lot of books about the beginning of the empire, the moment of success, the epic of battles, and so on and so forth. And then a lot of books and explanations about the end of the empire. And Felipe, it seems to me nobody's explaining why the empires can last, and why the European empires were so successful in comparative perspective, being in such an amount of lands and continents. And, well, we cannot understand and explain the global world of our times without the imperial experience. It seems to me that's a key point we try to explain, Miranda.
Very helpful to understand from the both of you, both the content that drew you to it, as well as obviously the key relationship between both of you. So thank you for starting us off with that background. I wonder if you can maybe take us into these questions of that you've both mentioned big picture questions around empire that you were curious about and brought you to this project. Why was the Spanish Empire such a good sort of case study to think about this durability of empire, to think about what makes them strong or weak? Why the Spanish Empire?
No, I'll let Manolo go first this time.
Well, I think because it was the first one in the Renaissance. First of all, it arrived very first with the Portuguese and the Spanish, and after the 1580s, at the same time, the empire of the Philip II and Philip III and the IV. And I think because, well, it's a unique case, because it is impossible to explain anything taking into account determinist elements. We love so much, we historians love so much, well, this approach to what is unexpected. We have these people suddenly in a place, well, never in the entire life coming from tradition, they could have the explanation of what was happening in front of them. Well, taking all the time, urgent decisions in order to survive. And I think that's the reason why the case of Spain and the Spanish Empire is so important. On the other hand, the great moment of epic in the Spanish Empire is coming roughly in the 16th century. After that, all was about surviving, adapting, being very flexible in front of course, cultures and civilizations of Asia, Africa, and the Americas. And that's another period, a very important moment of creole politics and, I would say, adaptation to local conditions, which, of course, it seems to me, Felipe, is at least one of the explanations we have to explain why it took so long to finish with the Spanish Empire.
Yes, I think the only thing I'd want to add, I thought that was an admirable exposition, but I guess I would want to add two things. One is the enormous environmental diversity of the Spanish Empire. I think if you want to understand empires, you have to start really by examining the one which is both the most representative and the most extraordinary simultaneously, and that's the Spanish Empire. And I think what makes it representative is pretty obvious. It's the first European overseas empire. It's, Manolo says, the first global empire, so it becomes representative of a kind of imperialism which becomes increasingly important in the modern era and, as Manolo has said, helps to fashion the world in which we live. But I think that what makes the Spanish Empire extraordinary isn't just, you know, what we've already covered in your opening remarks, Miranda, you mentioned one of the things that makes it extraordinary, which is the sort of mismatch, the kind of disproportion between the small, poor country from where the empire is founded and the vastness of the polity that results. But for me, the really inescapable, conspicuous peculiarities of the Spanish Empire are its environmental diversity, first of all. There's no other empire that exists on this scale in the tropics. No other European empire does more than, you know, take little bites out of the tropical world. The Spanish Empire occupies mountains higher than any European had ever seen before, and deserts, you know, bigger and more aggressive than any European had ever survived in. It crosses two vast oceans, including, you know, the Atlantic, which, you know, for centuries you would have tried to cross the Atlantic, and never, no one ever really succeeded in opening up viable routes to and fro across the ocean before the Spaniards did it. And as for the Pacific, you know, I mean, this is just the world's biggest ocean, and as far as we know, nobody had crossed it except Polynesians by island hopping ever before. And yet the Spanish Empire, you know, unifies the two shores of both of these empires. So just in environmental terms, it's unique. And then if you look at the cultural diversity, I think that's also extraordinary because, you know, we're talking about people who speak literally thousands of different languages with very contrasting social systems, religious traditions, at least most of them became Catholics under Spanish influence. You know, different ways of eating, different ways of organizing life and society and families. And they all come together in this almost kind of reality-defying single polity, which embraces more cultural diversity, I think, than had ever been encompassed in a single state in history. So those are the reasons, I think, for choosing the Spanish Empire. If you want to have the most challenging, the most representative, the strangest and the most instructive case in the history of empires worldwide and across time, go for the Spanish Empire.
It's in fact exactly because of those massive problems and especially the environmental challenges, Felipe, that you just mentioned, that I want to start talking about kind of how the empire tries to get over these challenges. Because quite literally, there were all sorts of things in the book, of a canyon that there was no bridge over and they wanted a bridge. Okay, well, it was, as you said, higher, steeper than anything that previous techniques that they were familiar with could be used for. So how, you know, on a really practical, on the ground level, how did Spain get engineers who were able to figure out what to do about these sorts of things?
The engineers are crucial, not only because the process of building the empire is a process of engaging with the environment, and engineering is the art and science which we humans use to modify hostile environments and turn them into those in which we can live, or in which we want to live. So the engineers are actually critical. I think they were, their work was also critical in reconciling subject and victim peoples of the empire to the existence of this great cosmopolitan polity. Because you've got to ask, you know, why did all these people just put up with the Spaniards? Why didn't they just throw the Spaniards out? After all, the Spaniards were never more than tiny minorities wherever they went. And really, they were kind of at the mercy of indigenous people. But in most places, you know, we don't get histories, long histories of resistance in the Spanish Empire, get long histories of collaboration. And I think that's because the work of the engineers created infrastructures, created economic possibilities, created trade routes, created new access to new markets, introduced new forms of economic exploitation, which were enriching, at least, you know, for the indigenous elites and for a kind of critical threshold, sort of mass of indigenous people who could profit from being part of the Spanish Empire, thanks to the work of the engineers. And in those respects, the engineers are absolutely critical. And I think Manolo and I felt that, although, you know, there have been people who've looked at the history of engineering in the Spanish Empire, they've looked at it in the past mainly from a sort of technical engineering perspective. And we saw the potential of looking at it from a historical perspective and understanding how engineering not just transformed the environment, but also made the empire work, made it function, made it viable as the kind of enterprise which all these subject and victim peoples were willing to buy into. I think for the specific answer to your question, Miranda, about how they got engineers to do this work, I think I better hand over to Manolo, since I've had more than my share of time on this question already.
Well, thank you very much, Felipe. I think Miranda is a fascinating question related to different chapters of the book, the history of trust and cultural interchange. For me, I have just one single example, which is fascinating for me. On the one hand, how you convince Europeans, not only coming from Spain, but from Italian states, Northern Europe, or any other places, just to use a bridge in the Andes made of vegetal elements with plants. Plants are not to make bridges, but that's, of course, the sort of element they had there in the forest or in the mountains. And, well, indigenous peoples managed, of course, to show how it was possible to trust and to cross in these huge mountains in the Andes without risk. And well, you have that question of how trust was built. On the other hand, there are some fascinating information coming from archives about how the experience of building a bridge was established in the Andes or in near Spain, in what is now Mexico, and how indigenous peoples at the moment the bridge was ready to use just escape because they fear everything was going to be destroyed, because they hadn't the possibility of just, well, imagine that element, that new element, building up and influencing the space and nature and environment was going to survive. So for me, that's very, very much at the very center of the arguments of the book, how this is a history of trust and interchange and social institutions as well. And I think it's extremely important, Miranda, to take into account how the free blacks or mulattoes, artisans, were working everywhere, traveling from one place to the other, how very different we have this approach to the indigenous world as something unified is completely mistaken. We have very, very different approach to experience of encounter with Europeans coming from different places of Europe as well. And I think I absolutely agree with Felipe. This is the history of the cultural limits and how globalization was something step by step about not the moment of the arrival, of course it is, but what's going to happen tomorrow? I'm going to stay here. What's the business of our future in common and how we need infrastructure just to imagine what's going to be next?
I don't think we've quite answered the one part of your question, Miranda, which was about the recruitment of engineers. I think in order to understand that, first of all, one's got to take into account the scale of the problems, because you know this is a vast empire with enormous environmental challenges, and there are just so many bridges and roads and hospitals and prisons and administrative buildings and schools and missions and forts and shipyards. There's just so much that needs to be supplied. You need engineers to do all of that. Also the sort of just getting water supplies to the cities, all this stuff required a lot of engineering skill. And there were never enough professional engineers. The Spanish monarchy invests quite heavily in engineering education and, you know, pays quite handsome salaries to engineers who are willing to go out and work on these colonial frontiers, but there are never enough. And for me, I wonder, I hope Manolo will agree with me here, the really critical difference is supplied by all these extraordinary amateurs, you know, priests and soldiers mainly, who don't often have specific engineering education. Sometimes some of the priests know a little bit about architecture, but they adapt and they supply the skills that are required, and they have the vision and the imagination to design stuff and take the tremendous risk of setting about building all of these infrastructural elements without necessarily being adequately trained professionally for the task. And to a great extent, the story we tell in the book is a story of heroic amateurs, supplemented, of course, by these great professionals, but there are never enough of the latter.
Absolutely, Felipe. I think there is a trip between these amateur engineers, priests, friars, or, well, maybe artisans or whatever, that just crossing the Atlantic or going to the Pacific and then, well, given the circumstances, being obliged to imagine cities, mines or shipyards or any other element of infrastructure. It must be said after the 18th century, we are speaking about the model related to continental Europe, Miranda, there was a new approach very much based in military engineers, Navy officers. The new Newtonian approach to intervention in open territories based, well, in the new presence of a state. And that's another very different history related to corps of engineers and so on. But I absolutely agree with Felipe, this sort of miracle of people just knowing how to make a fountain or something very small. And then suddenly in the inimaginable scale of what's in the Americas, after having a house, you must imagine what a city is, and you are in front of And one of the titles of the book, Felipe, I think it was your idea, of course, to write this chapter, is about the importance of the infrastructure of missions in the frontiers of the Spanish Empire. And I think it's very much one of the original arguments, it seems to me, of the book. Don't you think so?
Yes, I think that there are, you know, I hope there are lots of original things in the book. I think the overall approach is original. I think the recognizing that missions are themselves triumphs of engineering, which do all of the things that engineering had to do, but at the remotest frontiers of the empire, I think that is very important. I also think the chapter on health is quite quite original, because people haven't taken into account, in understanding the Spanish Empire, the enormous investment in building and manning hospitals, which this empire engaged in. And, you know, I don't want to just be a sort of an apologist for empire, because empires are, in my opinion, you know, fundamentally and basically evil things. I wouldn't want a lot of other people coming over and telling me how to you know, run my society. But one, you know, given the fact that empires are a fact of life, the Spanish Empire was a relatively benign empire, and you can measure that, you know, in the contribution that the Spanish monarchy made. It's huge investment in all these thousands of hospitals. I think that's a really important part of the book, which I hope will open people's eyes to, yes, this quality of, I think benignity is the right word for it, because of course these hospitals only existed, you know, for poor people, for indigenous people, for black people. If you were rich, you would never go to a hospital in the early modern period. You'd pay a doctor to come and see you. So these really were the very remarkable feature that I don't think has been covered in other histories of the Spanish Empire at all.
I'm glad you highlighted that and added it in, because it is a really interesting chapter of the book. I want to ask about another aspect that we haven't discussed yet, but I think is kind of speaks to the points you've been raising about these feats of engineering, about the practical aspect, about kind of the different people who have to work together to get something done. We often think kind of about the creation of empires being over there and happens in relation with, whether that's violent, coercive or not, indigenous people. But as you both point out in the book, first you have to get there. And getting across the Atlantic Ocean is not exactly a small thing. So I wonder if both of you can tell us a bit about kind of the challenges, the processes, the skills, the innovations that are needed to even get across the ocean in the first place.
Yeah, well, to get across the ocean in the first place, of course, the really significant technology, which we don't cover in the book because it happens before the Spanish Empire comes into being, is actually water cask technology. In order to spend a long time at sea, the really big prerequisite, which people had never been able to supply in the past, was sufficient drinking water to keep you going whilst you were out of sight of land and out of the possibility of recharging your water supplies. So I think it was, you know, a lot of people have written about, you know, ship design and rigging and navigational tools and so on. I didn't really think any of those were tremendously important in making transatlantic navigation possible for the first time, you know, possible on a regular basis with, routes to and fro right across the ocean. That's a new development from Columbus onwards. And I think that the water cask technology was the critical one, here. But, you know, I think the absolutely basic thing which makes the Spanish Empire possible is the willingness of Spaniards to undertake these terrible journeys. You rightly say, Miranda, that it was no easy task to cross the Atlantic. These ships were like sort of torture chambers. They were so sort of uncomfortable. The food was revolting. You were eating all this sort of salt food all the time. It went putrid. The water casks made it possible to carry drinkable water, but it still tended to be, you know, very inferior, especially by the time you arrived on the other side of the ocean. And if you didn't have an easy passage, if the winds weren't favorable, you know, it could take a tremendously long time. With a good following wind, you could do it in a couple of weeks if you were lucky, but these journeys could take well over 100 days if the winds didn't do their expected job and didn't turn up in the right place at the right time. So we're talking about long, grueling, hazardous voyages. People had no means for much of this period until the late 18th century of knowing where they were on the ocean in terms of longitude and latitude. Finding technologies were pretty rudimentary. So for most of the time, you literally didn't know where you were. and you know, your chances of ending up in the wrong place were quite substantial. And if you managed all that and you could tolerate the fetid conditions on board ship and the lack of adequate food and drink and if you weren't, you know, massacred in a mutiny, when you got there, you were in this extraordinary defiant environment that was entirely unfamiliar and which you had to adapt. So to me the really amazing prerequisite is that there were people in Spain who were willing to do this. And if you compare the Spanish Empire, say, with the French Empire, you know, the reason why the French Empire on the continent of the New World never really got going was that they couldn't persuade enough French people to go and endure all this misery and suffering. Although the British Empire was a little bit more successful in recruiting people, the Spanish remains, I think, very extraordinary in the success with which it mobilized such little manpower as it had available for this very daunting enterprise. And of course, you know, once you've got there, we know about how terrible empire was for the health of indigenous people. It was also actually pretty terrible for the health of the colonists, who also faced terrible body racking horrors in adjusting to the new environments and coping with the new diet and rarefied atmospheres and weather that they hadn't experienced before. So in all these respects, I think it was such a challenge that it's extraordinary that it happened at all. And for that, more important, I think, than any technological innovation was willingness on the part of Spaniards to go and play their role.
Well, I think, Miranda, after this masterpiece of explanation by Felipe, I would just add a couple of elements. I think how it was possible to make something predictable of the trips, how between, I would say, Felipe, 3 weeks and 3 months, you are going to arrive, and these people... hundreds of thousands of persons were crossing the Atlantic or the Pacific, going to Manila and the Philippines, brought almost 3 centuries. In the case of the China, the route to the Philippines, it was one of the longest routes in the trade in the history of humanity, 3 centuries of continuous travels going from America to Asia and then return to what is now Acapulco or any other port in what was at that time the Viceroyalty of New Spain. But in the end, it was predictable, and they managed to organize these fleets in order to arrive. And I would add another element, Miranda, which is how decentralized the structure of the fleets was organized. Because, well, the most important shipyard was, in fact, Felipe, in Havana, in Cuba. And then in Manila and then in Guayaquil, in what is now Ecuador. Of course, there was very important shipyards in Cadiz and in the north of Spain. But I think it was very much adapted to the conditions of materials, technology, knowledge of these people living in very different maritime cultures around the world. And of course, we need some comment coming from you about this question of how. Well, in the end, it was about connecting different maritime cultures throughout the different continents. Don't you think so?
Yes, I think you make a very good point. Of course, the rapidity with which the New World and even places in the Philippines were transformed into cities, environments which Europeans could recognize and feel at home in. That's also, you know, a vital part of making those journeys worth undertaking for these sort of heroic or rather sort of adventurous types. Perhaps heroic's not a good word, because many of them were desperados who only went to the New World because they couldn't succeed in the competitive, socially competitive environment of home. But in any case, what made it possible for them to do that was the transformation of these places in remote parts of the world, and again, engineers were critical in effecting those transformations. And, you know, the existence that Manolo mentions of all these very productive shipyards in Spanish colonies is a fantastic example. But, you know, you could also say these places often had, you know, amazingly well-built urban centres with magnificent cathedrals, libraries, universities, and the rapidity with which all this happened is really stunning. And I don't know, it still surprises me when I think about it, even after all the effort I put into understanding it, I still feel I'm only on the verge of doing so.
Very interesting to hear that from both of you. So thank you for taking us quite literally on that journey in many ways. And it still surprises me just how unpredictable, Manuel, as you said, the 3 weeks to 3 months. I mean, goodness, who would sign up for that? I wonder if I can ask, given that we've in many ways been sort of traveling through the book and through these ideas, through kind of different physical constructs, right? I asked about bridges. Felipe, you talked about hospitals. I've just asked about ships and getting across the ocean. Can I ask about fortifications? This is something I was particularly interested in because, of course, the borders of this empire get to be pretty massive. So the idea of having fortifications that can kind of defend the border in a way that we might think of today doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And yet there are fortifications that are built and they are serving some kind of purpose. What's going on with the fortifications?
Well, do you want to go first, Manolo?
I think it was very, very interesting just to think how, on the one hand, it is very much related to the heritage coming in Spanish American cities, in Cartagena or Veracruz or Havana or San Juan de Puerto Rico, many other places, Miranda. And it is there and it's very much, well, the Spanish Empire is represented as a part of a cultural heritage recognized by UNESCO or any other important institutions, and an element of cultural tourism, which of course is something very important. Monuments, something coming from the past in front of you, asking many people, well, about the origins and the past and the power of the past in the present, and I'd say in the future. But on the other hand, as you have just said, well, it's about the weakness. It's about, well, how it was impossible to defend as such. The Spanish Empire was too big. It was impossible to defend. It was impossible to pay. And one of the many elements which we try to analyze in the book was how the important was not the city or the inhabitants or the people, but the port. Just to have the port connected was the only possibility to survive in the moment of some attack of coming from the ocean. And there was this negotiation between these people coming from, I don't know, Jamaica or some French island or any other place, or in due course even what is now United States, and how, well, they were just asking for money in order just to not burn the city, like in the times of the Roman Empire. But I think in the end, what we have in front of us is the explanation of how limited was the globalization in the early modern period, how weak was the Spanish Empire at that time, and at the same time, how they managed to survive. And the question of how big it was one of the explanations of how they managed to survive. And, well, I think, on the other hand, it was this connection, very typical of frontiers in a global scale, between the most advanced technology and the most advanced engineering Europeans had at that time, people coming from the northern states of Italy, for example, to the Caribbean, Miranda, on the one hand, and in the other, how it was an impossible task to defend the empire with such a scale. What do you think, Felipe?
Yes, well, obviously, I agree with all that. I think it's worth saying that, strangely perhaps, the maritime routes that formed the global infrastructure of the empire and linked all these colonies together and linked them to the metropolis, that was actually, strangely, easier to defend than the landward frontiers of the empire. Because the Spaniards invested a lot in building fortifications and key ports and in a convoy system which made the transoceanic fleets almost invulnerable. In Dutch and English school children read stories of successful piratical raids. But the amazing thing is how few of these there were. And how rarely Spanish fleets were lost to enemy action, and how rarely piratical attacks on Spanish cities in the empire succeeded. I mean, there were some very conspicuous successes, especially, obviously, the British capture of Havana in the Seven Years' War. That was a great achievement by the British. But if you compare it with the even greater achievement of the Spaniards in defending most of these places successfully for such a long time, I do think it's an extraordinary record. The landward side, however, was much harder to defend because it was peopled very often by nomadic or semi-nomadic peoples, pastoral peoples, who had appropriated Spanish weapons and horses, and who constituted very formidable enemies whom it was very difficult to keep track of, like the Mapuche in the south of the South American cone. If you go to there's a museum in Santa Rita, which was assembled by the people who make Santa Rita wine in Chile. And it's the most extraordinary museum because it's full of all these Mapuche artifacts made out of the silver that they got in sort of ransom and payola and booty from the Spaniards. And of course, the same was true of the Comanche on the northern frontier of the Spanish Empire. Both the Mapuche and the Comanche were imperial peoples themselves with their own empires, subjugating their own native victims and subject communities. And they constituted very formidable enemies whom the Spaniards greatly respected and with whom they treated on equal terms in negotiations between their respective empires. And I think the key to success on these frontiers, which was admittedly, intermittent success, was never perfect, wasn't building fortifications. I mean, they did build fortifications, but they were of marginal use. And what, in the, I mean, in the book, we tell some extraordinary stories of how ill-equipped some of these fortresses were. You know, it turns out, you know, this long periods they didn't have any muskets, or if they had the muskets, they didn't have any ammunition. But it wasn't the fortifications themselves that really made the difference. It was two things. In part, it was those missions. Now, in vast areas in Florida, in California, in the Paraná Valley, these were vast frontier regions where it really wasn't practicable. There were no fortresses of any great significance. But the missions constituted the network of frontier defense, and they worked to a great extent to, you know, positive means of deterring invaders, or they absorbed the invasions and they fought the invaders off, because the missions themselves were able to mobilize large amounts of indigenous manpower to defend the empire. So that's the first element. And the second element was alliances with indigenous peoples on the frontiers. And eventually, of course, when the late 18th century, in the case of the Mapuches, in the mid-18th century, in the case of the Comanche, the Spaniards turned these long-standing enemies into allies, and to some extent into collaborators, and even, in the case of the Mapuche, loyal subjects of the empire. And those negotiations were always extremely difficult, and sometimes in retrospect it seems a miracle that they were achieved at all, but they were absolutely critical in keeping the empire going. So fortifications are really important, I think, in a maritime sense, less so on the landward side, where missions and indigenous alliances were the really critical means of defending the empire.
So it's actually missions I'd like to ask about next. Religious orders were pretty heavily involved in all of this. And in fact, in the book, you speak about how the religious orders, in some senses, thought that, well, really, the business of empire should be best left to them. Why did they think that? And to what extent did the state benefit from them being so involved?
Missionaries typically were in competition with the secular authorities in two very obvious ways. One was for control of indigenous people and the right to mobilize, deploy, and in some sense exploit indigenous labor. So that was perhaps the first cause of friction between the missionaries and the secular authorities. And the second, and I think in many ways even bigger, reason why these two vital parts of the Spanish Empire often loggerheads with one another, is that missionaries thought that they were pretty good at Christianizing indigenous people. Indeed, they were. You know, I mean, their record is pretty impressive. One, it's not easy to change someone's world view and cosmic vision, but these friars and Jesuits tended to be pretty good at that, and they felt that their success was compromised and subverted by the behavior of secular Spaniards who mistreated indigenous people, who failed to appreciate them, who set them a very bad example of basically Christian behavior, and whom, on the whole, it was better to keep as far from the indigenous people as they could possibly be kept. And that is one of the reasons why some of these mission frontiers were handed over by the crown to the missionaries, especially in Jesuit-controlled areas, to run without any secular Spaniards even being allowed to get near them. I think to some extent that helps to account for their success.
Well, I think, Miranda, about this point on Felipe, the question of the Jesuits is key, is extremely interesting, because the Jesuits arrived late. And as they arrived late, the Spanish Empire was at that time very much based in cities. Cities were the place of political governments, the elites, people coming from very different continents, or indigenous peoples coming from different places. And that's why at that moment, the frontiers was something between the cities, these big spaces, territories. In the case of South America, we're talking about all the frontiers of what is now Brazil, from Uruguay to Venezuela. It's a huge amount of territory. And I think at that moment, you have this unique combination, Felipe. On the one hand, the Jesuits arriving late, just searching for their own space and, well, their own ideas about what's going to be the experience of being a missionary. Very cosmopolitan experience, on the other hand, very unique in the case of the Jesuits. And at the same time, this question of how to define Miranda, who's going to take the responsibility of the frontiers, and it worked very well between, I'd say, the 1550s and the moment of the expulsion of the Jesuits in 1768 of the dominions of Charles III. It was more or less almost 2 centuries of presence in the frontiers, building up a Jesuit utopia. And at the same time, well, I think it was very, very safe for the empires. They managed to organize these so-called private armies of indigenous peoples. And they stopped the tropas de rescate coming from Portugal, people just hunting slaves in what is now all the frontiers of Brazil. But it's a combination of political crisis in the Spanish Empire which was at that time more or less arriving to the limits, and how these Jesuits were coming from very different pragmatic ideas about how to organize the infrastructure of empire and how to defend the limit, I would say.
Yeah, we tell a story of a Jesuit called Nicolás Mastrillo, who arrives as a sort of rookie missionary in Andamarca, one of the highest and remotest Jesuit missions in the world, in Peru in the 1590s. And he's this young man full of enthusiasm, writing a letter home to the fellow Jesuits whom he'd left behind in Spain in his house of study. And it's a very touching document because he describes how he, in the company of an older, more experienced missionary priest, goes off and crosses all these sort of mansions and jungles and undertakes this epic journey to try and find unconverted indigenous people to evangelize. And eventually, you know, they find some and they sit down with them, they attempt to communicate. And then suddenly, you know, this rival band of indigenous people come along and they say, "We don't believe that these guys are genuine Jesuits. We think they're Spaniards in disguise," which is an amazing thing because it shows you that these indigenous people thought the Spaniards, the secular Spaniards and the Jesuits must be, you know, different races because they behaved so differently. And so eventually, you know, this moment of anxiety passes, everything is patched up, and the according to Nicolás Mastrillo's letter, the reason why the indigenous people decide they're going to welcome these Jesuits is they say they were genuine, true fathers, that's the word they use, because they shared our food. And then they build, you know, this church out of palm leaves. It's the most extraordinary story, and I think it does take us to the heart of the question, both the question of how the Jesuits had different standards from secular Spaniards for relating to indigenous people, and also how they penetrated these unpenetrated frontiers, extending the reach of the Spanish monarchy, and finally how they established, you know, kind of protocols for mutual acceptance with the indigenous people amongst whom they worked.
We've covered rather a lot of ground, literally and in terms of the book. But before I ask you each what you might be working on next, is there anything else about the book you want to make sure our listeners are aware of?
Well, I'm going to hand over to Manolo here because we haven't talked, for example, about the 19th century, part of the book that he wrote entirely on his own without any input from me.
Well, I think it's just the element of how after the independence of Latin American countries at the beginning, well, throughout the imperial crisis and the civil wars 2 centuries ago, after now in 1824, it was the last battle, the Battle of Ayacucho in Peru. I think we try to offer something different about the action of engineers coming from civil corps and military engineers as well in Cuba and the Philippines. And what is interesting, I would say, Miranda, is how important innovations coming from the 19th century, I mean, the telephone, the telegraph, the railways were first introduced in Cuba and then in the Philippines than in Spain, in Europe. So I think it's a very interesting element just to take into account how modern was to be the introduction of technology was in these territories of Spain in the 19th century, and how, well, I think it's something very paradoxical we have to take into account.
And I suppose one should also say that, because we've been rather upbeat about our book, and I think we should say that quite a lot of it is about failures, sometimes sort of heroic failures, sometimes comic failures. But, you know, there are places where the bridges just couldn't be built, and there are all these sort of stories, and marvelous stories of canals. As Spanish were very interested also in improving rivers as means of communication and creating canals. Most of the canal stories end in disaster. they are quite in a macabre and sort of horrific way. They can be quite amusing. I guess we should point out that we do have a lot of stories of failure in the book as well.
Well, I would add, Felipe, Miranda, this is a history of something unexpected. I was thinking about one of my favorite heroes of the book, who is a military engineer, very undisciplined, very lazy, somebody not respecting at all hierarchy and being at the same time part of the Spanish army. And how he was punished he was sent to the Philippines suddenly he was in charge of almost everything there. Well, he had a wonderful and happy life. Something absolutely unexpected. That sort of histories, I think, are key to explain the action of, well, Spanish and global engineering throughout the early modern era.
Mm. Wonderful things to add in at the end of our conversation. Thank you both for that. I did say I had one final question, and I do. The book obviously has just come out, but given the publishing process, that means you had to finish it a bit of a time ago. Is there anything either of you are working on now that it's done that you'd like to preview or highlight, even if it's not working together or not on this topic?
Well, I'm writing a history of primatology, subject I've always been interested in. I've tried to teach a course on it at the University of Notre Dame for many years now, and I feel I'm now ready to write the story of how our human species interacted with those on this planet that are most like us, that's to say other primates and especially other apes. And it's an important story for understanding ourselves as well as for understanding our relationship to the whole of nature and the whole of our evolutionary past. And I hope it's been a humbling experience for me to learn so much about primatology in the course of it, and to learn how wonderful, how cognitively rich, how emotionally aware other non-human primates are, and how little really distinguishes us from them. But also to study this subject, which is a very important theme in the history of science that hasn't been adequately studied. So I'm working on that, and I'm also writing yet another history of the world, because Old Street Publishing and their wisdom have decided that there's scope for an even shorter history of the world than I or anybody else has written before. So I'm also working on that. Over to Manuel.
And I'm working now and researching a history of shipwrecks. I'm very interested in the question of how, well, we have this idea a shipwreck was just happening in a moment, in one day, 1 hour. But what is a surprise in this period is how shipwrecks can take a couple of weeks, and you survive a couple of weeks before losing your life. So I'm thinking about writing a book about this question, which, of course, I think it's very, very fascinating.
Well, those are some very fascinating projects to be working on. So thank you for the sneak preview. That's always a fun thing to end with. And to just remind listeners that, of course, the book we've been discussing, we've done a highlights tour version of. There's so much more in the book itself, and you can read it. It's titled How the Spanish Empire Was Built, A 400-Year History, published by Reaction. Felipe and Manuel, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you,
Miranda. Thank you very much.
Great treat.